Chapter 19. Maybe. The hotel where Fox brought Jacob was just as run down as the fake witch's shop. But the pain had weakened him more than he would admit, and the streets were deserted, so she couldn't find a cab that would have taken them to a better hotel. Jacob closed his eyes as soon as he stretched out on the bed. Fox stayed by his side until she was sure he was fast asleep. His breathing was too rapid, and she could still see the shadows the pain had left on his face. She gently stroked his forehead, as though her fingers could wipe away the shadows. Careful, Fox. But what could she do? Protect her heart and leave him alone with his death? She felt love stirring inside her like an animal roused from sleep. Sleep. She wanted to whisper to it. Go back to sleep. Or better still, be what you once were. Friendship, nothing else, without the craving for his touch. In his sleep, Jacob reached for his chest, as though his fingers needed to soothe the moth that was gnawing away at his heart. Eat my heart instead, Fox thought. What good is it to me anyway? Her heart felt so different when she wore her fur. To the vixen, even love tasted of freedom, and desire came and went like hunger, without the craving that came with being human. It was hard to leave Jacob behind. She was worried the pain would return, but what she was about to do, she did for him. Fox locked the dingy room behind her and carried the blood shard with her. Dunbar had probably left his desk by now. Morning was not far off. Fox had visited his home with Jacob only once, but the vixen never forgot a way. It was a little difficult to explain to the cab driver that she didn't have an address, that she would give him directions using trees and smells, but in the end, he dropped her off in front of the high hedge surrounding Dunbar's house. Fox rang the bell by the door half a dozen times before she heard an angry voice inside. Dunbar had probably not been in bed long. He opened the door a crack and pushed the barrel of a rifle through it, but he immediately lowered the weapon when he realized who was standing there. He waved Fox into his living room without saying a word. His late mother's portrait hung above the fireplace, and on the piano, next to a photograph of his father, was one of him and Jacob. "What are you doing here? I thought I made myself clear." Dunbar leaned the rifle against the wall. He listened into the dark hallway before closing the door. His father lived with him. Jacob had told her that the old Fear Darrig hardly left the house. Anyone would have eventually grown tired of being stared at all the time. There were still a few hundred Fear Darrigs in Ire, but here in Albion, they were as rare as a warm summer. Fox ran her fingers over the spines of the books, which surrounded Dunbar at home just as they did at the university. There had never been a single book in the house where she grew up. It was Jacob who taught her to love them. "So you now need a rifle if you've got a Fear Darrig in your house and in your blood?" "Let's just say it's better to be safe than sorry. But I've never had to use it. I'm still not sure whether rifles were a good invention or not. I guess that's the question with any invention. But I do feel it's a question one has to ask too often these days." He looked at Fox. "We're both stuck between the times, aren't we? We're wearing the past on our skins, but the future is too loud to be ignored. What has been and what will be? What is being lost and what is being gained?" Dunbar was a wise man, wiser than any man Fox knew, and on any other night, Fox would have loved nothing more than listening to him explain the world to her. But not on this night. "I am here so Jacob won't be lost, Dunbar."
"Jacob!" Dunbar laughed out loud. "Even if the whole world were lost, he'd just find himself another one."
"That wouldn't help him. He'll be dead in a few months if we don't find the crossbow." Dunbar had his father's cat eyes. Like Fox's, Fear Darrigs were creatures of the night. Fox could only hope those eyes could see she wasn't lying.
"Please, Dunbar.
Tell me where the head is.
The living room filled with thick silence. Tears might have helped, but she could never cry when she was afraid. Of course, the third shot. Giesmon's youngest son. Dunbar went to the piano and touched the keys. Is he that desperate that he puts his hope into some half-forgotten legend?
He's tried everything else.
Dunbar struck a key, and in that single note, Fox heard all the sadness of the world. This was not a good night. So the Red Fairy found him.
He went back to her himself.
Dunbar shook his head. Then he doesn't deserve better.
He did it for his brother. Talk, Fox. Dunbar believed in words. He lived among them. But the fairy's moth was eating Jacob's heart, and there were no words to stop it. Please.
For a brief moment, Fox was tempted to point the rifle at Dunbar's chest. The things fear made you do. And love. Dunbar looked at the rifle as though he'd guessed her thoughts. I nearly forgot. I'm talking to a vixen. Your human form is so misleading, though it suits you very well. Fox felt herself blush. Dunbar smiled, but his face quickly turned serious again. I don't know where the head is.
Yes, you do.
Really? And who says so?
The vixen.
Then let's put it this way. I don't know exactly, but I have a hunch. He picked up the rifle and stroked its long barrel. The crossbow is worth 100,000 rifles like this. One single shot would turn the man who wields it into a mass murderer. I'm sure they'll come up with machines that can do the same soon enough. The new magic is the old magic. The same goals. The same greed. Dunbar took aim at Fox. Then he lowered the rifle. I need your word. By the fur you're wearing, by Jacob's life, by all that's holy to you, that he will not sell the crossbow. I'll leave you my fur as a bond. No words had ever been more difficult to say. Dunbar shook his head. No, I won't ask that much. A head poked around the living room door. The rat snout was grey and the cat eyes were clouded by age. Dunbar turned around with a sigh.
Father, why aren't you sleeping?
He led the old man to the sofa where Fox was sitting. The two of you should have a lot you can talk about, Dunbar said. The old fear Darrig was eyeing Fox warily. Trust me, he knows everything about the blessings and the curse of wearing fur. He went to the door. It's an old tradition from a distant land, he said as he stepped out into the corridor. But for the past 200 years, Albion has believed in the miraculous properties of tea leaves, even at 5 in the morning. Maybe they'll make it easier for my tongue to say what you've come to hear. His father looked confused, but then he turned to Fox and looked at her with his milky eyes.
A vixen, if I'm not mistaken, he said. Since birth?
Fox shook her head.
I was 7. The fur was a gift.
The fear Darrig heaved a compassionate sigh.
Oh, that's not easy, he mumbled. 2 souls in 1 heart. I hope the human in you won't prove to be stronger in the end. They find it so much harder to make peace with the world.
Chapter 20. The Same Blood. More nothing. Neron threw another hand onto the pile of bones they'd already sifted through. Lelou had all but disappeared behind the pile. Ombre had smashed up one of the pews and stuck its wood into all the chandeliers, burning as torches, but the night smothered what little light they gave, and thousands of bones were still hidden in the dark, even from Goyle eyes.
What if the hand wasn't in the damn church? What if it was still somewhere out there in the damp earth? They can't possibly have dug up all the bones. Néron had run out of curses. He'd wished himself to 100 different places, and he must have asked himself more than 1,000 times whether Reckless had found the head yet. Still, all he could do was sift through another pale pile of human remains and hope for a miracle. Lelou and the watermen were helping him with moderate enthusiasm, but at least there were extra hands to sort the legs, skulls, and ribs from the bony fingers.
"The good ones to your pot, the bad ones to your crop."
He felt like Cinderella.
"Wrong thought, Néron."
That only reminded him that Reckless had found the glass slipper before him. The waterman lifted his head and reached for his pistol. Someone was coming through the church door. Louis stumbled over the first skull in his path. He reached for a hold on the nearest pillar. "The wine round here is even more sour than my mother's lemonade," he babbled. "And the girls are even uglier than you, Ombre." And of course he had to throw up over the bones they hadn't searched yet. "How much longer are you going to be doing this?" He wiped his tailored sleeve over his mouth and tottered towards Néron. "And anyway, all that treasure hunting, the magical crossbow. My father should be looking for engineers that are as good as Albion's instead." He stopped abruptly and stared at a pile of skulls to his left. Something was moving beneath them. Ombre drew his sabre, but Louis waved him away impatiently.
"I'll break his neck myself," he shouted drunkenly. "Can't be that hard, nasty little..."
Lelou shot Néron an alarmed look. A yellow follet's bite was nearly as dangerous as that of a viper. But what came crawling out from between the bones had neither a yellow skin nor legs or arms.
"Don't!"
Néron yelled as the waterman lifted his sabre. Three fingers, pale as wax. They moved as fast as locust legs. Néron tried to grab them and immediately let go with a curse. His arm was numb all the way up to the shoulder.
"The hand of a warlock! What were you thinking, Néron?"
The fingers scurried toward Louis. He stumbled back, but something was crawling down the pillar behind him. Thumb and forefinger, the second piece. Ombre hacked at them with his sabre, but the fingers skillfully dodged the blade. Louis tugged at his dagger, but he was too drunk to get it out of the scabbard.
"Damn it!"
he screeched.
"Do something!"
A piece of the hand was crawling up his boot.
"Grab it!"
Néron barked at him.
"Do it, now!"
There wasn't much of Gizmond's blood flowing through Louis's veins. Still, maybe it would give him enough protection. If not... But Louis was already leaning down. The fingers kept twitching like the legs of an unappetizingly large beetle, but they didn't give Louis a jolt. So the princeling was useful after all. Things were now crawling from all directions toward him. The two halves of the carpus slithered like turtles across the flagstones. Louis put the pieces together like a child playing with a grisly model kit. The dead flesh stuck together like warm wax. There was still gold on the stump and the fingernails. Néron smiled.
Yes, this was the right hand.
The swindle sack he pulled from his jacket was from the mountains of Anatolia, a place from which one didn't easily return alive. Still, every treasure hunter had to own at least one of these sacks. Whatever was put inside disappeared, and would re-emerge only when one reached for it deep within the sack. Néron held out the sack to Louis. The prince flinched away from him, and he hid the hand behind his back like a spoiled child. "No," he said, yanking the swindle sack from Neron's fingers.
"Why should you have it? The hand came to me."
Lelou couldn't hide his gleeful grin. The waterman, however, exchanged a look with Néron, and floating in that look, like pebbles in a pond, was the memory of every one of Louis's insults.
Good.
One day that might save him the trouble of having to snap the princeling's neck himself.
Chapter 21. Impossible. What would you do without her, Jacob?
Fox was looking out the train window, but he wasn't sure whether she was gazing at the fields drifting past outside, or at the reflection of her face in the glass. Jacob often caught her staring at her human form, as if she was staring at a stranger. Fox noticed his look, and she smiled at him with that mix of confidence and bashfulness only her human self knew. The vixen was never bashful. The steam of the locomotive drifted past the windows, and a coat-tailed waiter balanced cups and plates through the swaying dining car. Jacob felt as though the previous night's pain had sharpened his senses. The world around him seemed just as wondrous and strange as when he'd seen it the first time he came through the mirror. He touched the teacup the waiter brought him. The white porcelain was painted with elves, the kind that was still found on many flowers in Albion. At the next table, two men were arguing over the use of giantlings in the Albion Navy, and nearby, a woman's neck glistened with selkie tears, which were found all along the island's southern shores, like unshelled pearls. He still loved this world, even though it was trying to take his life. The tea was bitter, despite the elven cup, so bitter that he barely managed to get it down, but it helped against the fatigue the moth spite had left inside him. Fox reached for his hand. How are you feeling? We'll be there soon. Beyond the hills they could see the roofs of Goldsmouth, the home port of the Albion Navy. Beyond that was the sea, grey and vast. It seemed calmer than on their crossing. Good. Jacob couldn't believe he had to get on a ship again. Fox whispered across the table.
Do you still have money? Or did you spend it all on the blood shard?
Jacob knew a ship's outfitter who sold genuine Navy uniforms, but they weren't cheap, and his handkerchief was becoming less and less reliable. It had produced the last coin so reluctantly they'd nearly been unable to pay for their train tickets. Jacob put his hand in his pocket, and his fingers touched Earl King's card. He couldn't resist. He pulled it out.
That hurt, didn't it? And it will get worse with every bite. Fairies love the pain they cause to mortals. By the way, I visited your brother today.
Fox looked at him. Who's the card from? She tried to make the question sound casual, but Jacob knew who she was thinking of. She hadn't forgotten the Larkswater, and he could remember the pain in her eyes even more clearly than Clara's kisses.
Maybe you should have told her, Jacob.
He pushed the card across the table. The words were already fading as she reached for it.
It's a magical thing.
Fox turned the card around.
Naribo Johann Earl King?
The conductor came through the carriage to announce the next stop. Yes, and he didn't give me the card in this world. Jacob got up. The other world suddenly felt so close that the clothes everyone around him wore seemed like costumes. Top hats, buttoned boots, laced hems. He felt lost between the two worlds, neither here nor there.
What has he got to do with Will?
Yes, what?
It didn't sound as though this was just about a few heirlooms. Jacob didn't like it at all, but the mirror was far, and it might be weeks before he got to see Will again. If he got to see him again.
Oh, to hell with it. He would see his brother again.
Fox lifted the card to her nose, always the vixen, even in her human skin.
Silver, and there's a scent I don't recognize.
She returned the card to him and reached for her coat. Jacob had been with her when she bought it. The fabric was nearly the same colour as her fur.
I don't like that smell. Be careful.
The other travellers started pushing them toward the door. Though the platform was lost in the steam of the locomotive, the wind brought the smell of salt and tar from the port. Porters, cab drivers. There were two porters with wooden seats on their backs. They were waiting for the two dwarfs who'd been sitting behind them in the dining car. Being barely 3 feet tall and trying to push one's way through a train station was no fun. They took one of the cabs waiting in front of the station. Fox got off at the square where the ship's outfitters had their shops, but Jacob instructed the driver to take him to the port. They could only hope Dunbar was right with his theory about the Witch Slayer's head, but to be certain, they had to find a way to get on board the Royal Flagship first. Chapter 22 Iron Flanks. There they lay, hull by hull. The creaking of wet rope mingled with the screeching gulls and the voices of men readying their ships for departure. Albion's navy was matched by no other on this side of the mirror, and that confidence was stamped on the faces of every one of the sailors carrying ditty bags up the swaying gangways, and of the officers leaning on the railing. The flag with the crowned dragon flapped above them all. Albion wasn't even keeping the fleet's mission a secret. Jacob picked up a newspaper from the wet cobblestones. Every letter of the headline on the front page sprouted curlicues, yet was as clear as the headlines in his world.
Regal fleet to deliver arms to Flanders. From Albion's factory springs hope in the fight against the Goyle.
They felt very safe. Everybody knew about the Goyle's fear of the sea. Albion didn't supply weapons to just Flanders either. Her ships also took arms to the north, where an alliance was forming against the Goyle. Almost the entire fleet sailed under both steam and wind these days, and its cannon's firepower was legendary. But that still didn't seem to be enough for Wilfred the Walrus. Jacob stared at the sketch printed on the next page. Though he could barely make it out on the wet paper, his heart began to beat at a ridiculous pace, just as it did when he'd seen the airplanes in the Goyle fortress. The quest he'd abandoned so long ago. The trail that had always disappeared into nothing. And he'd stumble onto it again, in a place where he never would have thought to look.
The Vulcan and its berth in Gold's Mouth. Our tempered terror of the seas embarks on third mission to escort arms delivery. Masterpiece of Albion engineering sets Goyle a-tremble.
Jacob put down the newspaper and scanned the row of ships. To his left lay the ship he'd come to Goldsmouth for, the Titania, flagship of the Albion fleet, named after the King's mother. 376 crew, 45 cannons. The grimy waters of the harbour reflected the figurehead, but Jacob only gave her a cursory glance. His eyes were searching for the ship from the front page. Where was it? His glance wandered past wooden hulls and masts until it found pale sunlight reflected on metal. There she was. At the last berth. Grey. Ugly. Like a steel shark in a school of wooden mackerel. The low hull rose just a few feet above the water and was clad, like the funnels, in iron all the way down to the waterline. In Jacob's world, the first iron ships had been instrumental in deciding the American Civil War. This, however, was already a much more modern version.
Jacob, forget it.
But reason didn't stand a chance. His heart beat in his throat as he picked his way past crates and duffel bags, through groups of seamen hauling munitions and provisions, women saying farewell to their husbands, and children pressing teary faces into their father's uniforms. It was like stumbling through one of his dreams, only this forest was made up of ships' masts. Up close, the iron ship looked even more impressive. It was enormous, even though most of the hull was hidden beneath the waterline. Four men stood by the gangway that led from the pier up to the deck. Three of them were officers of the Regal Navy, but the fourth was wearing civilian clothes. That man had his back to Jacob. His hair was grey, and he wore it short, just as Jacob did.
What if it was him, after all these years? Turn back, Jacob. It's over. It's in the past.
But he was 12 again. The moth on his chest was forgotten. Forgotten, too, was what he'd come here for. He just stood there and stared at the iron ship and at the back of a stranger.
Jacob!
A cabin boy ran past him, two boxes of cigars under his scrawny arms. A final errand for the officers. He looked up in alarm as Jacob grabbed hold of him. Do you know who that man is? The one standing with the officers. The boy gave him a look as though Jacob had asked him to name the son.
That's Brunel. He built the Vulcan, and he's already planning a new ship.
Jacob let the boy go. One of the officers looked around, but the civilian still had his back to Jacob.
Brunel.
Not a very common name. Isambard Kingdom Brunel was one of his father's heroes. Jacob had barely been 7 when John Reckless had tried to explain Brunel's Iron Bridge blueprints to him. All those years, and now there were just a few steps left.
Mr. Brunel?
How timid his voice sounded, as though he really was 12 again. Brunel turned around, and Jacob found himself looking into the eyes of a stranger. Only the eyes were as grey as his father's. Jacob wasn't sure what he felt. Disappointment? Relief? Both?
Say something, Jacob. Go on.
Brunel? That's an unusual name.
My father was from Lotharain. Brunel smiled. May I ask who...
Why, that's Jacob Reckless.
The officer standing next to Brunel gave Jacob a nod.
Quite a different kind of trade, John. Hunting for old magic. And this man here happens to be very good at it.
He offered his hand to Jacob.
Cunningham. Not nearly as interesting a name. Lieutenant in the Regal Navy. Pleased to make your acquaintance. Thankfully, our newspapers still like to publish reports about treasure hunters, even if they mostly poke fun at the artifacts these days. A medal from the Austrian Empress for a glass slipper, the Iron Cross of Bavaria for a pair of 7-league boots. I admit to harbouring some envy for your trade. As a child, I was determined to pursue your profession and no other.
Congratulations.
Brunel gave Jacob an appreciative nod. His accent didn't at all sound Lotharainian. Behind them, torpedoes were being loaded on board. They'd shred any wooden hull like paper. Cunningham's eyes followed Jacob as he bade the men farewell. Brunel, however, had already turned his attention to the ship again. Albion's new magician. Relief and disappointment. An old hope, all but forgotten. Jacob barely saw where he was walking. Barrels, ropes, crates. Everything around him was blurred, like his face on the dark glass of the mirror.
Look at that, Jacob. This bridge is weightless and as perfect as a spider's web, but it's made of iron.
Did he even remember what his father looked like? He remembered his voice. The hands that had lifted him onto the desk so he could touch the model planes that hung above it.
Jacob!
Someone grabbed his arm. Fox.
The outfitter wanted a fortune.
She shot a furtive glance at the sailors hauling sacks of coal to the Titania's cargo hatch.
I only had enough for one uniform. Have you found a way to get us on board? Damn.
He'd found out nothing. He'd so lost himself in memories that he'd nearly forgotten he soon would have no future.
What's with you?
Fox looked worried.
Did something happen?
No, nothing. And that was the truth. Nothing had happened. He'd seen a ghost, the same ghost he kept stumbling after in his dreams. It was high time he buried not just his mother, but also his father. He'd thought he'd done so already. He took the bundled uniform off Fox. A few sailors were staring so openly at her that Jacob gave them a sharp look. "How will you get on board?" Fox shrugged.
"I'll let the vixen find a way."
"That's too dangerous."
"Mr. Reckless!"
Jacob turned around. He'd expected Brunel's slender face, but it was Cunningham who was standing behind him. The officer bowed stiffly to Fox and gave Jacob a slightly awkward smile.
"We are only set to sea in an hour. I would like to introduce you to our captain. I'm sure he'd find some of your adventures very interesting."
Jacob quickly had a polite refusal on the tip of his tongue, but Fox interceded.
"Which ship do you serve on, Mr. Cunningham?"
Cunningham pointed behind him.
"The Titania. We're escorting a shipment of arms to Flanders. We sail at sunset."
Fox gave Cunningham her most seductive smile.
"It will be our pleasure," she said,
taking the bundle with the uniform from Jacob's arms and quickly hiding it behind her back. Cunningham's bearded face beamed with delight, and Jacob sent a silent apology to all the reporters he'd ever cursed for the lies and exaggerations they had published about him.
"Certainly," he said. "We're in no rush. I wouldn't even mind coming along for the whole journey. I love going on voyages." A more brazen lie had never left his lips. Cunningham looked as though he couldn't believe his luck. The captain of the Titania shared his first officer's passion for treasure hunting. He put them up in the cabin the king himself used whenever he paid a visit to his flagship. When Cunningham introduced them as Jacob Reckless and wife, Jacob had to explain that Fox was only blushing because they hadn't been married long. It was just one of the many lies he'd have to come up with over the next hours. The captain served them a dinner opulent enough for a journey of 300 days instead of 3. As the Titania weighed anchor, the ship's cook was serving dessert, and Jacob found it increasingly difficult to ignore the movements of the ship while Cunningham quizzed him about adventures that had been completely made up by some newspaper. When the captain, whose moustache was just as dreadful as his king's, began quizzing Jacob about the butchering techniques of ogres, Fox used the bloody subject as a pretext to excuse herself. Jacob would have loved to follow her, but Cunningham wouldn't let him go. Jacob had to console himself with the fact that by the time he'd be able to get away, Fox would have checked all the guards and escape routes on board. Through the stern windows of the captain's cabin, Jacob could see lanterns of other frigates, and ahead were the moonlit iron flanks of Brunel's ship. Would Mr. Brunel be on board the Vulcan on a voyage like this? Jacob was proud of the nonchalance with which he asked the question. The captain shook his head with disdain.
"To my knowledge, he's never even left Albion. Isn't that right, Cunningham?"
His first officer nodded as he poured himself another glass of port.
"Brunel's not too fond of the sea."
"And his ship shows it." The captain downed his glass as though he could wash away the iron ship with it.
"Sadly, our king has been smitten with Brunel ever since he built that horseless carriage. You see them everywhere now. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. That iron monstrosity out there is making us the laughing stock of the world. Our metal babysitter."
Jacob's eyes were glued to the Vulcan, while Cunningham and the captain waxed lyrical about past military engagements at sea and the beauty of wooden ships on fire. When the two officers began to discuss the penetration power of modern cannons and the annoyance of smashed-up limbs, Jacob quickly made his excuses, though they would have certainly loved the story about Chanute's missing arm. The silver moon, which resembled the one in the other world so much, was standing between the black clouds. Its red twin stained the waves like rusty metal. Fox was waiting at the bow. Below her, the figurehead stretched over the frothy waters.
"How's your stomach?"
Nobody except her knew about his dislike of sea travel. Not even Chanute.
"You're lucky the sea is calm."
And lucky that an officer of the Regal Navy had recognized him after he mistook Albion's leading engineer for his father. Maybe his luck had returned. About time.
Three guards on the prow,
Fox whispered.
I'll distract them while you climb over the railing.
One of the guards was leaning just a few yards away between the lifeboats, looking in their direction.
What did he see?
Lovers in the moonlight?
And what if that were true, Jacob?
What if he allowed himself to forget what Fox had been to him all these years? Even the guard wanted to kiss her. It was written all over his face.
You'd break her heart, Jacob. Or Fox his. What are you waiting for?
She put the backpack in his hand. Don't give him too much hope. He's nearly two heads taller than you. Fox smiled.
I think you have the more dangerous task.
She sauntered toward the guard in a straight line, just as the vixen approached her prey. Jacob leaned over the railing. The figurehead had the body of a dragon, but the head of a man. Dunbar had first noticed how much the gilded face resembled statues of the Witch Slayer during his research for a lecture on the history of the Regal Navy. Jacob still thought it was a rather far-fetched theory, but the figure supposedly came alive whenever the fleet was attacked. The head of a warlock to protect Albion's fleet. Some black magic was always useful, even in these modern times. Dunbar claimed that Fire Feast's great-great-grandson had begun the tradition of fitting the flagship's figurehead with the miraculous head, not knowing that it was that of his wizarding ancestor. Jacob looked around.
Robert Lewis Dunbar, I hope you're not wrong about this.
He couldn't see the guard anymore.
Where had Fox lured him? Forget about it, Jacob. She's a grown-up.
He took the Rapunzel hair from the snuff tin where he kept it. The golden hair was one of the few items he hadn't lost in the Goyle Fortress, thanks to Valiant. Jacob rubbed it between his fingers, and the hair grew fibre on fibre until it was stronger than any hemp rope. Jacob tied one end to the railing. The other end he dropped down, and it immediately wrapped itself around the neck of the figurehead. He jumped over the railing and rappelled down the glistening rope until he could clamber onto the dragon's back.
Don't look down, Jacob.
He could stand on any precipice without the slightest reaction from his stomach, but the sight of the water beneath nearly made him vomit all over Gizmond's golden head. The dragon's wings, which were pressed against its body, were also covered with golden scales, but its body and neck were made of scarlet-painted wood. Jacob loosened the Rapunzel rope from the bulky neck and tied it around his waist. Then he pulled a fishing net from his backpack and wrapped it around the head and neck so that the head, once he cut it off, wouldn't just drop into the ocean. His fingers were damp from the spray, and the high waves made him slip twice, but the Rapunzel rope saved him from falling into the water. The head was attached to the dragon's neck with a broad metal band, but the knife Jacob pulled from his belt could even cut through steel. He'd stolen it from the kitchen of Valiant's castle. There was nothing better than a dwarf knife, and Valiant owed Jacob much more than a knife anyway for the scars he bore on his back. On the horizon, the first light of morning was eating into the night like mould.
Hurry, Jacob!
Of course, he expected that Gizmond had secured his three bequests with a spell that would allow only his children to touch them without harm. So before Jacob slipped the knife through the net, he pulled on the gloves that had protected him in the tomb. The knife cut through the metal band like fresh bread, and as he touched the head, he felt nothing.
The gloves worked. Good.
Jacob was halfway through when he heard a sound from above. Fox was standing by the railing. He motioned her to wait up there. The figurehead's mounting didn't look strong enough to support them both. Suddenly, the wooden body beneath him bucked. Even though it was only connected by a few inches of metal, the golden head opened its mouth and let out a scream that resounded far across the water. Jacob heard the engines even before the planes appeared out of the dawn light. a squadron of double-deckers was headed toward them across the black waves. The sailors were so dumbfounded that the planes managed to reach the ships before a single gun was aimed at them. They bore down on the Albion fleet like an army of eagles swooping down on a swarm of defenseless fish. Their red fuselages were painted with the black outline of a salamander, which had replaced the fairy's moth on the Goyle crest ever since their king had taken a human wife. The figurehead flapped its wings, and Gizmon's head screamed through the net that Jacob had pulled over its gilded skin. He held on tight to the dragon's neck as the first bombs exploded between the ships. Screams and shots joined the noise of the howling engines. Explosions tore through the wooden hulls, and men dropped from the riggings like birds. Fire rained from the sky, setting even the sea itself aflame.
"The head, Jacob, or you'll soon be as dead as those already being eaten by the fish down there, even if you manage to survive today."
Above him, Fox was trying desperately to steady the rope. Jacob clawed his fingers into the net. He ducked just before one of the wings could slice its barbed shoulder through his back. Fox was screaming something at him, but Jacob couldn't hear her through the noise. And he could hardly see anything either. His eyes were burning from the biting smoke gathering between the ships. Even the wind reeked of powder and burning wood, but the planes kept up their attacks. The howl of their engines nearly burst Jacob's eardrums, and the Titania groaned like a wounded animal.
"Jacob, the head!"
He pulled the knife through the last bit of metal, and finally, the head dropped into the net. The gilded face stared up at him, its mouth still wide open in mid-scream. He pulled a swindle sack from beneath his wet shirt. It clung to his trembling fingers. Jacob tugged it over his loot and then looked up at the railing. Fox held onto the ship with one hand, steadying the Rapunzel rope with the other. They could barely see each other through the thickening smoke that was enveloping the ship. The deck was on fire, but he had to get up there. Fox was up there, and maybe not all the lifeboats had been put out to water yet. She started to haul in the rope, though she could barely hold on. The Titania was swaying too wildly, and Jacob was heavy. The flagship was sinking, together with the entire Albion fleet. Drifting among the burning frigates was the iron ship, its armoured flanks torn open, and planes swarming over it like scarlet wasps. Jacob tucked the swindle sack back under his shirt and began to climb, his feet pushing against the hull to make Fox's work easier. Underneath, the figurehead still flapped its wings like a beheaded chicken. The warning Fox screamed over the railing came too late. Jacob tried to dodge the wings, but their barbs were as sharp as blades. The black magic inside them cut through the Rapunzel rope, barely a hand's breadth above Jacob's head, and he dropped like a stone toward the blazing water. Chapter 23. Mal de Mer. Jacob wasn't sure whether his ears were filled with his own scream or the calls of the drowning men floating all around him. The sea was frigid, despite the burning ships. He grabbed hold of a drifting plank while he desperately tried to spot Fox on the flagship above. But the smoke was too thick. Jacob hoped she'd jumped, because the big ship was going to take everything with it when it sank. He yelled her name, but he could hardly even hear his own voice. The screams and moans were too loud, as though the waves were suddenly roaring through 1,000 human throats. An explosion tore up one of the sinking ships, and the Titania started listing dangerously, yet Jacob kept searching for Fox among the floating bodies and debris.
Where was she?
He yanked the head of every passing corpse out of the water. Their pale faces floated like wax blossoms between the charred sails and the empty powder kegs. He could barely feel his limbs anymore in the icy water, and the smoke made every breath an ordeal. But he had to find her.
Jacob!
Wet arms wrapped around his neck. A cold cheek pressed against his. Fox's red hair, which stuck to her face, was so wet that it looked almost black. Jacob squeezed her tight and could feel her heartbeat through their wet clothes. He didn't dare let her go, afraid the waves would wash her away again.
You have the head?
Yes.
We have to get away from here.
Away to where? Jacob looked around. What was Dunbar going to think when he opened his paper in the morning? Iron ships, airplanes, bombs falling from the skies? Would he wonder whether they'd drowned with the head? Would he finally begin to fear the new magic of technology as much as he feared that of the Witch Slayer?
The coast can't be far. We were sailing southeast for hours.
Whatever she said. The planes were gone, but there would definitely not be any rescue mission.
Come.
Fox pulled him with her. She seemed certain in what direction the coast lay.
Swim, Jacob.
The smoke followed them for a long time. The smoke. The debris. The cries for help. But finally there was nothing around them but the sea, heaving like a giant animal, digesting all the bodies it had just drowned. Fox looked at him with concern. She was a good swimmer, but Jacob's arms were getting heavy, and every wave left him gasping for air. Fox came to swim by his side, but he only got slower and slower.
Don't hold on to her, Jacob.
He would pull her down with him. His skin was numb, and he felt himself losing consciousness.
Jacob!
Fox wrapped her arms around him and pulled his head out of the water.
You won't make it to the shore. Let yourself sink, do you hear?
Sink? What was she talking about? He tried to breathe, but even the air seemed to be made of salt water.
It's your only chance. They don't come to the surface.
They? Fox pulled him down before he could understand what she meant. Water rushed into his mouth and nose. He tried to resist, but Fox wouldn't let go. She pulled him deeper and deeper, no matter how much he struggled. Jacob tried to push her away. He wanted to breathe, only breathe. But then suddenly he felt other hands, warm and slender, like the hands of children. They pushed one of their scales into his mouth, and his lungs began to breathe the water as though they'd never done anything else. The bodies floating around him and Fox were transparent, like frosted glass. Fish or human? They were both. The Lotharanians called them Maldamare, but they had a different name on every coast. It was said that they capsized boats to take the souls of the dead to their cities at the bottom of the sea. The Empress had a specimen of a Maldamare in her chambers of miracles, but death had turned its crystalline beauty into dull wax. They swarmed around Fox as though she were one of them, weaving flowers into her hair, stroking her face, but she would not let go of Jacob, and when they tried to pull him deeper, she pushed the naiads away. It was like a dance between her and them until at some point Jacob felt a wave wash him onto firm ground. He felt damp sand, shells crushing between his fingers. His eyes burnt from the salty water, but he managed to open them to see clouds and a grey sky above. Fox was crouched next to him. She was also too weak to get to her feet, but they dragged each other along, away from the water's hissing waves that still sounded so hungry until, exhausted, they finally dropped side by side onto the sand. Jacob spat out the scale the Maldamare had pushed between his lips, and he greedily gulped the damp air into his burning lungs. It was salty and cold, and more delicious than anything he'd ever tasted.
Breathing.
Just to be breathing. Fox reached for the blossoms the Maldamare had put into her hair. Underwater they'd shone in all colours of the rainbow, but now they were wilted and dull. Fox threw them into the waves as if trying to give them back their life. Then she knelt down again next to Jacob and dug her hands deep into the grey sand.
That was close.
Her voice sounded as though she couldn't believe that they were still alive.
Alive.
Jacob reached under his wet shirt, but all his fingers found was the moth. The swindle sack with the head was gone. Fox smiled as she put her hand up her sleeve. She pulled out the sack and threw it onto his chest. The gloves, like his backpack, had been claimed by the sea. Still, as Jacob put his hand into the sack and touched the golden hair, all he felt was a slight tingling. Swindle sacks could have a dampening effect on black magic, though Jacob had never seen such a strong effect. It didn't matter. He had the head. He could only hope that the Goyle had been less successful in the meantime. Jacob tied up the sack and looked at the sky, where a few hungry gulls circled among the clouds. In his mind's eye, he could still see the red airplanes diving at the burning ships. Why did the Maldemar help us? Fox was wiping the sand from her bare arms. She'd pulled her dress off in the water, and now she was just wearing the one of fur. She wore it beneath her clothes whenever things might get dangerous, but this time it wasn't the vixen who had saved them, but her human self. They usually only help women, she said. When I was a child, they saved my mother's sister. Normally they take the men with them, and I wasn't sure if I'd be able to protect you from them. But without their help, you would have drowned. Fox smiled. Luckily, they realized I wasn't going to let them have you without a fight. Yes, luckily. She was so fearless, it sometimes scared him. Jacob sat up. He could only hope the hand and the heart would be easier to find. Not that he really expected they would be. He looked around. Steep sandy cliffs and a pebbly beach. A lighthouse in the distance. Do you know where we are? Fox nodded. I grew up not far from here. I asked the Maldemar to take us here. We're in Lotharain, just a few miles from the Flandrian border. She got to her feet. We'd better see that we move on, though. The fishermen here are not very friendly towards strangers. You still have the gold handkerchief? We'll need money for horses and new clothes. Jacob reached into his pocket. The handkerchief was soaking wet, but Earl King's card dropped from his pocket as dry and untouched as though it had just snuck into his hand. Fox gave the card a nervous look, but it was blank except for Earl King's name. The card was pearly white, as though the sea had washed away the ink. Jacob shooed away a little spider that had crawled from his pocket, then he tucked the card away again. He still wanted to throw it out, but ever since he'd seen Will's name on it, the card felt like a connection to his brother, even though Jacob knew the notion was irrational. The handkerchief usually worked even when it was wet, but Jacob had to rub it for what seemed an eternity before it finally released one paper-thin coin. Yes, he really needed a new one, but these handkerchiefs weren't easy to find. Jacob poured out the water from his boots. How many times has it been now? He got to his feet. How many times has what been? Fox could also barely stand. They were both shivering in their wet clothes. That you saved my skin. Fox smiled as she brushed the sand off his back. I think we're nearly even. Chapter 24. A Boot Print. Coast. His hand. Almost crushed. The spider danced haltingly, as though she'd swallowed as much water as her sister. Albion had lost its fleet, and Neron had almost lost his eight-legged spy. Luckily, twin spiders were made of hardier stuff than ships of wood or iron, and Reckless had also done quite well, if the spider's report was true. Fire from the sky, water, smoke, death. Neron had some trouble figuring out exactly what had happened, but in the end, all he needed to know were two things. The Goyle attack had made the crossbow even more attractive to all their enemies, and Reckless had made it back to the mainland, with the head. Oh, this race was fun! Even if the princeling had the hand for now. And speak of the devil! The knocks on Neron's door sounded like someone who wasn't used to standing in front of closed doors. Neron nudged the spider back into the medallion and opened the door.
Look at this!
Louis shoved a discoloured shirt sleeve into Neron's face.
They can't even wash clothes in his dump. And what do you think my father will say when I telegraph him that Lelou had to pick lice from my hair this morning?
Neron pictured the chandelier he wanted to build from Louis's bones. Imagination was such a wonderful gift.
What are we looking for next?
Ah, he'd tasted blood. The hunger for the hunt. Louis had far too many royal robbers in his ancestry to be immune to it.
Get the others and meet me behind the stables.
Neron wanted to slam the door shut, but Louis put his expensive boot in the jam.
You're not really the chatty kind, Goyle. I think you're not telling us everything you know about this search.
And why should I, my princeling? So you or your dad might get the idea to search for the crossbow yourselves?
Ask Lelou. He'll know more than I,
Neron replied.
And about those lice. Why don't you just have the landlord waive your wine bill?
Louis picked a particularly fat specimen from his forehead and crushed it with disgust between his fingers.
Fine, he said, pulling his boot out of the door. Behind the stables. But remember, I don't like waiting.
Of course, it was Neron who ended up waiting. Maybe they found some more lice. Quite astonishing that Louis's eau de toilette didn't kill them all on the spot. Ambre trudged silently behind his royal charge, but Lelou was talking at Louis in his usual breathless way. He only quieted when he saw Neron beside the saddled horses.
Lelou says you told him we also have to find a heart and a head before we get the crossbow.
Louis had the swindle sack with the hand hanging from his gold-studded belt. He ran his fingers over it, as if to remind them that so far he was the more successful treasure hunter, not Neron.
Blue-blooded idiot.
Neron gave him his most innocent smile.
Yes, that is correct, he said.
Best to let Lelou think he had every detail about this hunt. It would keep the bug from asking too many questions. But now it was time to deviate a little from the truth. He put on a concerned face.
Sadly, I just had news that a spy from Albion has gotten hold of the head, and he may get the heart before we catch up with him by coach or train. So I suggest we use magic to stop him.
A deep frown furrowed Louis's deceptively high forehead.
Albion. Always Albion, he growled. My father's too nice to them.
Lelou rubbed his pointy nose.
I travelled with magic once. It's very unhealthy. My own shadow started talking to me afterward.
Neron pulled a leather pouch from his saddlebag.
Not to worry. We Goyle use magic that has no side effects.
He didn't actually know if that applied to humans, but of course he didn't mention that little detail. The pouch contained soil Neron had collected from a boot print near the elevators at the mine where Gizmon's tomb was discovered. He was certain it belonged to Reckless. Lelou watched warily as Neron spread the soil on a flat stone. What an opportunity to get rid of them all. He could barely resist the temptation. But Louis still had the hand, and Lelou's knowledge might prove useful in the search for the heart.
What about the waterman, Neron?
He shot a quick look at Ambre. Neron's instinct told him that Ambre might yet prove useful, even if only to kill the other two.
There. It's quite simple, as long as you do exactly as I say.
Neron waved them to his side impatiently.
Hold the reins in your left hand and put your right hand on the shoulder of the man in front of you.
Lelou had to stand on his tiptoes to reach Louis's shoulders, and the princeling pulled on his calf-leather gloves before he touched the waterman. Ombre, however, clawed his fingers into Neron's shoulder as if he wanted to remind him how much damage they could do. Neron pressed his boot into the soil Jacob Reckless had stood on a few days earlier. He smelled salt in the air.
Water. He shuddered.
Hopefully, they weren't about to land up to their necks in it.